subsidize advanced sectors of industry. This is something that started during World War II, when corporate managers went to Washington and learned the lesson of Keynes, not because they read Keynes, but because they saw what happened. They learned that massive state control of the economy, massive state intervention in the economy, could overcome the crisis of capitalism. This was particularly dramatic because the New Deal measures had almost completely failed. But the massive control, the establishment of a basically totalitarian state command economy during the Second World War, that worked, and industrial production increased. They learned the lesson, and from that point on, they were committed. They recognized that capitalism is a historical anachronism. It's finished. And from now on, we have a powerful state carrying out industrial management and serving to maintain advanced sectors of industry, the part where U.S. is competitive. Now, how do you do it? There was a debate in the late 40s. It was recognized, as economists tell you, that you could do it through social welfare spending and all sorts of other things. But the problem is that that doesn't meet the primary need, which is to preserve the rights and power of private business. All sorts of other measures you can imagine that the economists point out to you are quite feasible, have the property that they mobilize other segments of the society, they redistribute income, they engage people in social planning, they interfere with the prerogatives of management. In fact, in general, they induce a crisis of democracy and so on, and therefore they're out. The military system, as was pointed out in the business press quite clearly in the late 40s, is not like that. The military system is just a gift to advanced industry. It's a publicly subsidized, state-guaranteed market that they can use for waste production. It means that the public will pay the costly phase of research and development, then the profits will be privatized. And it's a cushion that corporate managers can use. When they can sell to the private market, they'll do it. They can appeal to this cushion when they don't have to do it. It's perfect from the point of view of a Keynesian technique for maintaining the state capitalist system, but also the needs and prerogatives of the private forces that own it. It's a way of forcing the public to subsidize wealth and profit. And in that respect, it's perfect. Take SDI expenditures. You want to understand SDI, Star Wars, take a look at a study done by the OECD, the European Economic Community, which points out that SDI expenditures match very closely the expenditures, the distribution of expenses organized by Japan's state-controlled economy, which the United States is unable to duplicate for a variety of social and historical reasons. SDI also has the very useful effect of spurring the arms race, as well as subsidizing high-tech industry and therefore making sure that the system is perpetuated. Notice that this is not a matter of military industry, as is commonly stated. Take, say, computers, the core of a modern industrial economy. In the 1950s, when computers were not marketable, they were 100% purchased by the government. That means the taxpayer, which means that the taxpayer, through the Pentagon, supported the research and development. When computers became saleable on the market, they were handed over to private enterprise to privatize the profits. Currently, we're engaged in the development of so-called fifth-generation computers, very costly procedure of research and development. Plainly, business doesn't want to pay it. They'd rather have the taxpayer pay it, and we are. Through the military system, it's in fact 100% funded, the fifth generation project, through the Pentagon and NASA, which is just an adjunct of the Pentagon, and the Department of Energy, with the producer of nuclear weapons. And this is very typical for most aspects of advanced technology. Well, sometimes it's argued that this kind of planning is lunatic, which is perfectly true, but also totally irrelevant. The point is that in government, as in business, planning is short range. The long term is someone else's concern. And this is quite natural, quite rational, in fact, in a competitive society where those who do not devote themselves to short-term advantages are not going to be in the competition when the long run comes along. So we should not be at all surprised at any of the things that I've mentioned. They're completely rational within the framework of short-term advantage, and the fact that they lead to long-term suicide is essentially an irrelevance for planning. So the public may express overwhelming support for a nuclear freeze and for cuts in military and social spending, as it does, but this is an irrelevance, as is the clear feasibility of a nuclear freeze, a comprehensive test ban, ban on missile testing, and many other measures that would enhance the possibilities of survival. The public has very little voice in such matters, and public concern is, the public opinion is of no more concern to elite groups that control the state apparatus than security, survival, human rights, the raising of the living standards, democratization, and other noble slogans. This is not because the leadership are bad people, and in fact, very little is likely to change if so-called better people take their place. The reasons are institutional, and the problems have to be confronted without illusions, with understanding of the social realities, with a good deal of persistence and courage and dedication among people who hope to survive any of this. Thank you. You want me to, why don't we just all, would the people who are leaving mind doing it quietly so we can hear? Thanks. Go ahead.
I just wanted to start by saying thank you for being here. I think you're great.
Thanks.
The question, or actually just the thought, is there's going to be a show called America, which will be airing, I believe, February 15th. And I thought maybe we can hear, you know, just a thought about how you feel about it. Because my feelings about it is a whole, you know, the whole Reagan mentality, or the whole institutional, actually, I should say, mentality, right-wing mentality, and, you know, they're just reaching, you know, to the point where they're just trying everything. It's very obvious, but, you know, I feel there's a lot of people out there who just, you know, are not awakened to the to what we heard tonight, that they fall for what Reagan was saying, and I'm very afraid about this show.
Well, I haven't seen the show, of course, although I was offered to, the ABC offered to show me a preview of it. I was, however, interviewed, and, you know, if you're interested in this sort of thing, you may find 15 seconds of it on the air somewhere. I had about an hour interview with the producer there in order to show how, you know, broad-minded they are and so on. They're interviewing quite a range of people about the show, and they say they're going to show tiny excerpts of this. They say they're going to show excerpts. They will be, if anything, tiny and misleading excerpts. But when they asked me what I thought about, I didn't want to bother viewing it. It sounded like a waste of time. So I wouldn't comment on the show itself, but on the general idea, which was clear enough, the main suggestion that they asked me one question on the interview. They said that the main focus in the show, of the show as they saw it, they said it was misunderstood. It wasn't anti-Russian propaganda or jingoist propaganda. It was rather a kind of an in-depth study of how people act under military occupation, kind of a profound psychological inquiry into this topic. And they asked me how I thought Americans would react. Suppose we were under, say, Soviet occupation, how did I think various sectors of the population would respond? And on the basis of historical evidence, and I told them the answer on the basis of my own reading of the historical evidence, namely, you would have the Ronald Reagans reading the ads for the occupiers, and you would have the people who dissent and protest today dissenting and protesting then. That's probably what you'd have. But then when they asked me what my general objection to the show was, and I had obviously indicated I did have an objection, I said that I thought if they wanted to study this problem, there was a much more obvious way of doing it. They could study what the Soviet Union would be like under American occupation. The reason is that we actually have plans and have had plans since we know since the late 1940s and probably today, we don't have the current documents, we have had plans to break up the Soviet Union and occupy it and make an agreement with successor states, and we tried to implement those plans, at least up to the early 1950s, supporting Hitler's armies in the Carpathian Mountains and elsewhere. So since we actually had those programs, in fact, we might ask how Americans might react to the discovery of armies in the Rockies supported by the Russians established by Hitler. We might think there's some, take that with some discomfort. But since these programs really exist, that's the obvious thing to study. Since they're not just studying that one, it's plainly cheap propaganda. I think it's also a good occasion for educational efforts. I think, you know, it will reach a lot of people. They say, I think, what, 50 million people or something. which means that people are concerned about the impact of this kind of cheap propaganda, cheap chauvinist propaganda, do have an opportunity to contact and reach people who, and try to educate them about it. So I don't think it should be abandoned. I think it's an opportunity. Wells?
I was quite struck by one thing you said, that the selling of weapons to Iran via Israel, financed by Saudi Arabia, you said was carried on for a quite different purpose.
Yeah. What was the purpose? Well, if we want to know the purpose of the arms sales to Iran through Israel, the claimed purpose, you remember, is to establish contact with what are called Iranian moderates and to deal with the hostages. So you want to test that out. An obvious question to ask is, what were we doing before there were any hostages? That would serve to test the question whether the hostages are, say, a factor in the selling of arms to Iran via Israel. Well, that's an easy one to answer. There were no hostages in 1981 and 1982, so what were we doing then? Well, the answer is we were selling arms to Iran via Israel. In fact, that was completely public. The pretense of the media that they're surprised by all of this is a total fraud. The New York Times, for example, had a front page article in, I think, March 1982, written by Leslie Gelb, who's now their managing editor, and I presume didn't forget it, in which he stated that half the arms to Iran are going from Israel, and that of the other half, they're going from private arms dealers, most of whom probably have secret contacts with Israel. Now, arms from Israel means U.S. sale of arms. They make whatever pretense they like, but the relations of dependence between Israel and the United States are such that Israel does things like that with U.S. authorization or not at all. So the fact is that, and there's plenty of other evidence for this. Moshe Ahrens, the Israel's ambassador to the United States, in October 1982 had an interview with the Boston Globe in which he stated that Israel was sending arms to Iran in coordination with, I'm quoting, in coordination with the U.S. government at almost the highest of levels. And the point was, he said, to ensure that we would be in a position to either carry off a military coup in Iran or to be in a proper position to take over the successor role after Khomeini. Furthermore, the Israelis were completely open about this, as were high-level American officials. Incidentally, a lot of this stuff is discussed in a book of mine, which came out in 1983, Fateful Triangle, it's called. And if you have it around page 457, there's some discussion of this from the public record. I got a good memory for things like that. This remembers before there were any hostages, you know, none of this stuff. So, for example, in an hour-long program over the BBC, which I quoted at some length, devoted to this topic. This is February 1982. They interviewed top high-level Israeli officials and also high-level Americans. The Israelis who they interviewed are exactly the ones who are now identified as being right at the center of this arms trade. David Kimchi, who was the head of the Foreign Office, Yaakov Nimrodi, they call a private businessman. He was actually the Israeli military attaché in Iran, which means an agent of the Mossad. Uri Lubrani, who was the last Israeli ambassador to Iran, and so on. And these guys are perfectly straight. They say, of course we're selling arms to Iran. The purpose, as Lubrani put it, is to find military officers who are willing to kill 10,000 people and carry off a military coup which will restore the relation under the Shah. That's what we call moderates. If you think that I'm exaggerating, in the press here, people like General Suharto are called moderates. For example, Suharto was called a moderate in the Christian Science Monitor just 2 days ago, and this is standard. Why is Suharto a moderate? Well, because he successfully slaughtered 700,000 people or so in a few months in an operation which was widely applauded in the United States, in particular by American liberals, because it succeeded in doing exactly what we're trying to do in Iran. Namely, it overthrew a government with which we had hostile relations. Now, that's an interesting model. There's nothing new about what we're doing in Iran. In the case of Suharto, the United States was very hostile to the government that preceded, the Sukarno government, so hostile, in fact, that we launched an invasion from the Philippines with mercenaries in 1958, and in fact, U.S. pilots flying for the CIA, one of them was shot down in supporting that attack. We tried to overthrow the regime with a coup, that didn't work. We then continued to send arms to Iran, to Indonesia. Throughout the whole period of building hostility, we sent arms to Indonesia, nobody could understand this, but it paid dividends, as Robert McNamara later said in the Senate testimony. It paid dividends, in his words, namely with the Suharto coup, pro-American coup, which led to the slaughter of hundreds of thousands of people, mostly landless peasants, and destroyed the only mass-based political party, thus overcoming the crisis of democracy, and inoculated that part of the world from the virus that was threatening of independence there. Well, that's not the only case. Take Chile. We were very hostile to the Allende government, but we continued to fund the military, and that too paid dividends. We got Pinochet, another moderate, and we immediately supported him. And in fact, that's why you fund the military. You fund them so as to maintain control for exactly the reasons that I described in that document on the secret document on U.S. relations with the Latin American military. You fund the military so that you can maintain predominant influence and you can find at least elements who will understand things in the terms of the associates from whom they're getting arms and training and supplies. And when it's a hostile government, when it's a client government, you hope that the government, that the military will perform their function. Remember what that is, to overthrow civilians if in the judgment of the military, which conforms to our judgment, they don't serve the interests of the nation. And if it's a hostile government, you fund the military so that they'll carry out a bloody military coup like Pinochet or Suharto or whoever they're looking for in Iran. Absolutely typical. In that very same BBC program where the Israeli officials, exactly the ones who are now identified, so not new people, where they made it very clear that that was their intent, a number of high-level American officials were interviewed. For example, Richard Helms, former head of the CIA and former ambassador to Iran, he was asked what he thought about all of this, and he said, well, he's not in the CIA now, but he assumes that that's exactly what the CIA is doing. At least that's the obvious thing for them to do. They have to try to find assets, you know, moderates, who will be able to carry out a military coup. Robert Comer was interviewed. He's an old Defense Department official who was involved in the Phoenix program and other nice operations in Vietnam, major war criminal, in fact, and high in the Pentagon in Carter's administration. He was one of the guys who organized the Rapid Deployment Force, now called the Central Command. That's big military intervention force aimed at the Middle East. And he said he thought this was a good idea, and in fact that you could, he said, well, we can't invade to establish a new government, but if a military coup takes place, we can use the Rapid Deployment Force to support it, namely to defend it against the population. So that's a technique we might have in mind. Edward Luttwak, who's another well-known strategist, so-called, he was interviewed and he said, yeah, I mean, he was a little skeptical about whether we could do it, but obviously the right thing. William Sullivan, another ambassador to Iran, was interviewed. He said, had no objection to it, but he said it's going to cause carnage, you know, total carnage, not just 10,000 people killed. But those are the considerations. Can we get away with it? Now, this was going on before there were any hostages. The term moderates is just more Orwell. You know, they're moderates in the same sense in which Suharto is a moderate. They follow orders. That makes them a moderate. In fact, this was more or less revealed in a secret Israeli government document that surfaced just yesterday, yesterday in the Washington Post, in a story by this is Amiram Nir, who's Paris's anti-terrorism expert, so-called, and the memorandums, which was handed to George Bush a long time ago, it just surfaced, said that we're not dealing with moderates, we're dealing with the most radical elements in Iran, meaning the most brutal and vicious. And that makes sense. Those are the Suhartos and the Pinochets. That's who you want to be in touch with and in control of. And the purpose, he said, was to ensure our position in the post-Khomeini succession. So I assume that that's been the purpose all along. No reason to believe that any policy's changed since the early 1980s. And it makes a certain sense. It makes a certain sense in terms of a sufficiently, if you assume a state sufficiently committed to violence and massacre, and there's no reason not to make that assumption in the light of history, that's exactly the sensible program. We probably started it off right after the Khomeini revolution. In fact, in February 1979, before Khomeini was even in, but after the Shah had left, Carter sent a top NATO general, Robert Heuser, to Iran, apparently with the purpose of trying to stimulate a military coup. We don't know that for certain, but that seems to be the case. And he apparently couldn't get the Iranian generals to carry it off. And I think if the truth of this matter ever comes out, we'll find that from that point on, the United States simply followed the classic pattern, trying to find military officers who would act in the way that we describe in secret documents, like the one I read, and will, in fact, carry off some kind of a bloody coup, Sukarno, Suharto, and Pinochet style, and restore the friendly relations that existed under the Shah. I imagine that's the true story. At least that's what the evidence points to.
Paul Bowman, who certainly would advocate transferring wealth from the poor to the rich, wrote that he would prefer that his daughter sing America the Beautiful and even pledge allegiance to the American flag at public schools than always learn to despise or desecrate the United States in certain alternative schools. And I'm curious about what you think about that and also what you like about the United States.
Well, it depends what you mean by the United States. If you mean by the United States, this is the people.
Here you got to be a little careful.
The country that we live, that refers to a lot of different things. Yeah, it refers to the population, to cultural forms, to social relations, all sorts of things. And in fact, there are a lot of good things here, very good things. For example, in the notice that I talked about the success of popular movements in indirectly influencing decisions in a society that has virtually nothing in the way of politics. Well, why was that success achieved? Success was achieved because of something that's in fact very good about the United States, which I mentioned, in fact, namely that the state is quite limited in its capacity to coerce its citizens by force. Not zero, but limited. In particular, the more privileged elements of the population, like us, I assume most of you, certainly me, those segments are pretty much by relative standards, by world standards, are relatively free from state violence. That's exactly why people like Walter Lippmann and Harold Lasswell and the public relations industry and so on emphasize the need for thought control in the passages I referred to. They emphasize that the United States needs commissars, people like most of us, you know. It needs an intellectual elite. It needs institutions for the indoctrination of the young, as the liberals put it, because it doesn't have it doesn't have resources of violence to use against its own population. Well, those are good things about the United States. Also, the U.S. government, the state, despite the efforts of Reaganite statist fanatics to strengthen the state and weaken the rights of citizens, despite those efforts, the United States still remains rather, you know, in the spectrum of existing societies, at the libertarian end, in the ability of the population to gain access to information about the government. That's why I'm able to quote those documents, right? Because we're relatively free in that respect. There's also one of the best things about the United States, you find out as soon as you leave elite educated circles, namely the Vietnam syndrome exists. That's very important. It exists among the general population. Here's a good thing about the United States. When the polls ask, what is your attitude toward the Vietnam War? In particular, do you think it was a mistake or was it fundamentally wrong and immoral? When that question is asked, 72% of the population says it was not a mistake, it is fundamentally wrong and immoral. That answer is given by 40% of the people called opinion leaders, meaning clergy and so on, and it's given by virtually none of the educated intellectuals and was not given by them even at the height of protest against the war. So among the commissars, that is the educated elite, it is virtually 100% always has been held that it's a mistake, but the population happens to have a much higher moral and intellectual level and says, no, it wasn't a mistake, it was fundamentally wrong and immoral. Okay, those are all very good things about American society. There are also plenty of bad things. What furthers that type of good thing is that many things. One thing is that there has always been a strongly libertarian strain in American culture, an individualist strain, opposition to state power. Now, elites have tried very hard to destroy it, and for long periods they have, but it continues to rise. Another thing that strengthens some of these factors, here the situation really becomes complex, so you got to think about it. Though the United States is, of course, not a capitalist society, and everyone knows that a capitalist society couldn't possibly exist for a minute, business foremost. They were strongly opposed to capitalism a century ago for good reasons and insisted on state intervention and regulation of markets and protection of their interests and so on. The United States has always been highly protectionist, and business wants a strong state and always has. Nevertheless, in the spectrum of world societies, the United States is towards the sort of, if you spread them, the United States is kind of towards the capitalist extreme. Now, in a capitalist society, we're very far from being there, and as I say, such a society could not exist for a week. But we're towards that end, and in a capitalist society, everything tends to become a commodity, that is, for sale, people, for instance. Freedom also tends to become a commodity, meaning you can have as much of it as you can buy. And there are certain groups who benefit from that, namely the rich. The rich benefit from, the more freedom there is, the more the rich benefit, because they can purchase more of it. For the poor, it doesn't mean much, it's formal. This is quite a meaningful thing. For somebody like me, say, like when I was on the enemy's list, or when I was arrested, or something like that, I could appeal to the formal freedoms that exist, because I'm part of the privileged elite, like us. And therefore, I could get a good lawyer and, you know, do all that business. If I was, say, Fred Hampton, a Black Panther organizer in the ghetto, who the National Political Police arranged to have assassinated by the Chicago police, I couldn't. Formal freedoms don't mean a damn thing. I couldn't appeal to them because I would then not be part of the privileged elite. But the point is that the freedom, which largely benefits the wealthy and the privileged, is going to be defended by the people who benefit from it. And since they are the people who happen to run the place, they're going to defend the freedoms. And that means that the rest of us also benefit from them. So in a complex and indirect way, we do end up having a large measure of freedom from state coercion, precisely because that benefits the people who can purchase it, the rich and the powerful who run the private society and the state. And that means the rest of us benefit. And in a very wealthy society like the United States, that includes pretty large sectors of the population. So these are also factors. And so, like anything in the world, it's complicated when you look at it.
Just 2 points. On your last visit to Cornell, which I believe was in 1980, you gave what turned out to be a very accurate prediction of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. And I wonder if you'd like to play Jimmy the Greek for us again with his prediction of the invasion of Nicaragua.
Of Nicaragua?
Yeah, the second point.
I thought you were going to say invasion of Syria, but...
The second point is, if I follow your train of logic properly, you describe line of thought about a system of imperialism, of domestic repression, and state intervention in the economy in terms of military spending, which basically, if you put it in ABC Marx's terms, appears to be responsible for what might be called the crisis of overproduction. And I'm wondering if I'm following your logic correctly, is that the central tenet of this, or central raison d'etre for this system? And if so, what are the methods for combating that?
Well, as for the invasion of Nicaragua, my feeling up until recently was that they were not going to invade Nicaragua, contrary to most of my friends. And my reasons for believing this were on the assumption that they're rather rational. Again, contrary to a lot of people, I think that the Reagan administration, not Reagan, who probably doesn't even know what the policies are, but the people who are making policy have been, which tells you something about American democracy, incidentally, but... The people who are making policy have been quite sophisticated, and they've carried out an impressive and successful series of international terrorist operations and programs of state, of turning the state into a welfare state for the rich and so on and so forth. And on rational grounds, it would be a mistake to invade Nicaragua. The reason is it would be costly to elite interests. And the program that they're following ought to work in the long run. I mean, Nicaragua is a tiny country. I mean, you know, an invisible country. It's possible to, and the United States is a huge, violent superpower. Therefore, it's possible to construct, to develop, I mean, we can buy off, we can purchase a mercenary army with our power and wealth that can harass and torture and maim and kill and mutilate in Nicaragua forever, maybe at a low level of intensity, but enough to ensure that the government cannot carry out the programs of social reform. And that's our primary commitment. Incidentally, administration officials concede this. You look in the small print, and you will find that you will find cases where they actually state that the Contras, or the resistance, as they're called by the party line press, the Contras attacking Nicaragua, which the Times and so on calls the resistance, that they will not succeed in overthrowing the government, but they will, I'm virtually quoting, succeed in forcing the government to divert its resources towards defense and away from social reform. And that's the primary concern. We've got to make sure that they don't carry out what Oxfam called the threat of a good example. And that has been the, and that's correct, that's a correct analysis. The U.S., it's wrong to think that Nicaragua was no threat to the United States. It's a major threat. As soon as they began developing substantial improvement in health programs, clinics, great growth in literacy, diversion of resources to production of subsistence crops instead of export crops and so on, that rang the alarm bells in Washington, because that's the threat of a good example. When Oxfam, charitable development agency, says that the Nicaraguan government is unique among 76 developing countries in the commitment of the government to the development process,